that tough love, the discipline, all of these things in regards to how a man is treated differently from a female, that those things are things that we also see happening, right? Certain expectations for females, certain expectations for men.
Yeah.
So how does that impact in regards to how you felt like you had to manage life? That's one of the things that we've noticed is that the men, they feel alone. They feel unbelieved, right? So it's hard for them to open up to other people about it. Let's be honest, the majority of people providing the service are women.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we know it. We're a trigger.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, I didn't think about that. Okay.
It is okay to be vulnerable. It is okay to ask for help. It is okay that you didn't hit back. You're not weak for not doing that. If anything, it's more courage.
Agreed.
And just the fact that you are believed. More than anything, you're believed and you're seen. Heal yourself.
Excellent.
I mean, ultimately, you got to heal yourself. If you're not healthy, you're not going to be able to maintain a healthy relationship. And it's not to ever say that a survivor is at fault. No, you will never be at fault of someone else's behavior. But we do know psychologically, there is something internalized that attracts us to a certain person, right?
Correct.
And it could be that that person triggers us in a certain way that, have you ever heard someone say, and we hear this a lot, but they feel like home,
mm-hmm.
but they feel familiar.
Absolutely.
And they feel like there's a bond there. There is. It's most of the time trauma bonding. It's one of those things in which the feelings get dismissed, the feeling powerless gets dismissed and ridiculed. So this is something that we're trying to break that cycle in, but it's still very much prevalent in there. Most of the time it has to do with if your home wasn't very healthy, it does feel like home. But the problem with that is that then we're always looking for that external piece to make us feel whole instead of feeling whole.
Okay.
And then sharing it with someone else.
Yes.
But was your home healthy? You know, did they show ways to really manage emotions, to be able to deal with a conflict in a healthier way? So that's the piece, looking internally, because ultimately what does happen is that the more you realize your worth, your value, and how you should be addressed and talked to and treated, the more you don't put up with a person that will act that way. Yeah!
Welcome to Why Daddy Never Cries podcast with your host, Chuck Kelleher. At Why Daddy Never Cries, we'll explore the lives surrounding daddies, their children, divorce, and silent domestic violence. We'll hear real-life horror stories from unsung heroes fighting for the ability to stay in their children's lives. We'll get those voices heard and hopefully find solutions before you lunatics burn the whole place to the ground. Hang in there, daddies. Chuck's here.
Chuck Kelleher and Why Daddy Never Cries are providing this podcast as a public service. I've known Chuck for 45 years, and he's neither a lawyer nor a mental health professional. He's not a doctor nor a rogue scholar by any stretch of the imagination. Chuck is simply a guy who's lived in hell for 20 years. Once he found a way out, he drew a map to help others navigate their own way home. The views and opinions expressed by Why Daddy Never Cries, employees, or our guests are their own. Guest appearance on the program do not imply an endorsement of them, their opinions, or any entity they represent. And please, for the love of God, if you have any questions or fears about your unique circumstances, please contact a lawyer, a religious leader of your choice, or a medical professional in your area. Don't fuck this up, brothers, because we're all in this together.
We'd like to thank our sponsor, Voss G2, for helping small and medium-sized businesses elevate their brand perception with design. Take your brand to the next level at VossG2.com. We'd also like to thank Harry Duran and his team at Fullcast for their amazing assistance. If you're planning a podcast and you haven't contacted Fullcast, you might as well call your show Podfade.
How are we doing, everybody? Today, we're here with Erica Calderon from Barrier Free Living, Secret Garden Counseling, and Freedom House Safe Shelter based in New York City. Erica, how are we doing today?
I'm good, Chuck. It's nice to see you. What makes our program unique is the fact that we work with those who have a disability. So it's survivors of domestic violence who have a disability that can be from medical to cognitive to physical to just mental health as well. Nobody has to prove this disability in order to be able to get services. I can definitely touch on all of them and tell you a little bit in regards to how each service provides to the survivors of domestic violence. I specifically am the program director for Secret Garden, which is the non-res program. What that means is that We are more community-based in regards to the fact that Freedom House is our crisis shelter for those who are in the midst of domestic violence and need to be able to have a safe place to go. And then from there, some may qualify. And we also assist clients to be able to get supportive housing. And supportive housing specifically is for two buildings. We have the family building and we have the singles building. Depending on what you qualify for, people have to go through the process of supportive housing applications in order to be eligible for a specific category or population. And they determine that. And then people end up being able to have an apartment, which is stable housing for a long time.
And is this strictly in the Bronx or throughout the entire city?
We serve all of New York City.
Oh, beautiful. The apartments are located throughout the city or strictly in the Bronx?
They're in the Bronx.
Okay.
They're in the Bronx, yeah.
Let's see. So Bear Free Living's been around for 43 years, which is amazing. Secret Gardens, the next one, which is you're the director of?
Yes, the program director.
The program director for Secret Gardens. That's 27 years. I'm getting a lot of guys calling, how do I start a shelter? I'm like, I have no idea, but we'll find out.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Barrier Free Living. There are a number of groups out in the United States right now who are interested in starting domestic violence shelters. Mm-hmm. And as you and I were just talking, the programmatic thing might be beneficial. Probably touch on that equally as well.
Definitely. The interesting thing is that all of our programs are funded differently through different types of city, state, federal funding that occurs. I can tell you for Secret Garden, we have many different contracts from different types of funders. And in regards to, like, for example, the Office of Victim Services is one. HRA is our biggest one, which is Human Resources Administration. We have OCFS. And we also have in regards to a contract for those who have been sexually assaulted. So we have different contracts from different funders. Honestly, always looking out for RFPs. I would tell them, you know, look out for funding opportunities. Look for things that the mayor's office is doing in regards to what are the grants that are out there. They're called the RFPs in order to be able to see. And based on the population and what you're trying to do, you can apply for it. It's possible, but I'll be honest, I feel like that's the reason why the CEO has the hat that she has, because she's really good in regards to understanding that piece. But
okay,
possible. Yeah, it's a lot to go through.
That is a lot.
Yeah.
RFP, request for proposal.
Request for proposals. Yep.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's out there. Even recently, some of the RFPs have been released. So we do know that we're even like looking into that to see what fits best and if is it a good opportunity in order to continue the program. Because what happens with these contracts is that they're contracts for a certain amount of years. You show them that there's still a need. You show them that the clients are still benefiting from them. You continue to reapply in order to be able to get that funding source.
Right. That makes sense. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And now Barrier Free Living, that's open to everyone.
Absolutely.
Race, creed, color, sexual orientation, across the board.
Absolutely.
God bless.
Yes. Men, women, LGBTQ, disability piece is the piece that makes us the most unique. And we also provide services for those who are deaf or hard of hearing. So we also have the accessibility to have an interpreter for, let's say, ASL or other types of sign language.
Yeah, my sister can speak ASL.
Oh, that's good. It's good language to have.
Oh, yeah. And then Secret Gardens opened up about 27 years ago.
Yes, the non-res piece of it.
The non-res piece.
Yeah. So I've been there for 4 years. Specifically, what we provide is case management, right? So case managers, what they assist is being able to link clients to resources for stability, especially housing. Let's say benefits about for food stamps, Medicaid, Medicare, making sure that whatever need that person has, we can definitely link them to the agency, help them with the application process. We also have social workers that specifically provide the counseling piece. So the counseling can be for domestic violence in regards to the trauma that was experienced. And we have the sexual assault coordinator that is specifically for the sexual assault that they went through. Then we also have the occupational therapy piece for those who would like to be able to learn skills for independent living. Also, for example, let's say that they would like to get back out there and be independent and start working and they don't know how to work a resume or how to be able to talk to someone out there in the job market about, you know, their skill sets, and they can work with an OT person with that. And we also have a case manager specifically for the legal services for family law. So we have a partnership with Sanctuary for Families. And that is in order for the person to be able to get, for example, an order of protection, mm-hmm. custody battles, when it comes to child support. We try to do a roundabout of different services so that the person can get that stability that they need.
Oh, that's great. And as we both know, it's not just a one-stop problem to fix. There's a lot of different avenues.
I was watching your video on The Secret Garden, the man hiding the car keys from his wife. I assumed it was his wife. And she's like, oh, you know, forgetful. I'm so forgetful. Heartbreaking. It is heartbreaking that people do this to each other.
Absolutely.
Fortunately, you just read the news and you could figure out how cruel people can be. However, as we preach, it is a beautiful world if you keep looking.
Yes.
A lot of people like to focus on the ugly, but there's so much beauty out there that we seem to be missing.
Yeah, and that's what really motivates our work, is because we get to see the how the person grows, right? And because we're all together as like these sister programs, what's great is that even though a person is at the shelter and we know that it's temporary, that same person can continue with Secret Garden. And then we continue to see them grow. It was great to see that this past year, we were able to get a good amount of about 16 or 17 clients get their own apartment for the first time.
Nice.
So be able to have their housing, be able to see that they want to go back to school. They want to be able to start working and feel that independence. And you see it, right? You see just even the physical change of a person that is feeling empowered.
The shoulders go back. They stand up straight. Oh, it's a beautiful thing.
It is.
See, it's almost like a butterfly transformation.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not really.
No, yeah. You know, stress ages us, right? Like you could see it, like, and then to be able to see like the years peeling off and we're like, oh my God, they look even younger than when they first started.
It gives you shingles too. Yeah. They ran through the four things that give you shingles and, you know, it was age, stress. I'm like, bing, bing, bing.
Yeah, stress. Absolutely. And that's the main thing. It's like, we don't, you know, we talk to our clients about how they're carrying the stress. And because for so many of our clients, it's like, well, this is all I've known. They're no longer even feeling that pain threshold that emotionally is happening, but it's coming out in all these other ways and symptoms.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Now, how would somebody contact Barrier Free Living? I mean, obviously they can call any of the numbers. I'm sure it's all the same. Does it all ring to the same switchboard?
Yes. So we have a hotline, which I'm happy to share. Our hotline is 212-533-4358. And the hotline is specifically, it is 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. But we then basically shoot it out for the after hours to Safe Horizon, which, as you know, is also a domestic violence hotline. What's great about it is that we also have another way of people contacting us. Barrier Free Living has this website that, let's say that the person cannot give us a call because it's unsafe.
Yes.
So we have this chat feature, which a person will be there. And then at the end, we will take down their basic information to make sure that we can contact them. And we do ask, you know, what is the safest time to be able to reach you? And one of our workers will call and be able to provide the services that way. We also do have partnership with other agencies. We basically have a partnership with the Family Justice Centers of Staten Island, Queens, Manhattan, and Brooklyn.
Oh, wow.
So we get a lot of our referrals through that as well. And, you know, we do tabling events. We definitely try to make sure that we're out in the community, that schools are aware of us. So we'll go to certain colleges and be able to make sure that we can be a source of support for even, because it starts as young as, you know, unfortunately, high school, college.
Yeah.
These things are happening. We try to definitely make sure that people know that we're here, that they can reach us.
Now, you were saying it starts early, and yeah, we both know domestic violence doesn't discriminate against age, unfortunately.
Yeah,
we're finding a lot of generational trauma.
Mm-hmm.
How much do you see in the younger victims? Do you see it? They're coming from families of domestic violence a lot?
Yes. Unfortunately, the majority of our clients, it's because they already are in that situation because of the parents.
Mm-hmm.
They end up in the shelter system with their family, especially, let's say, you know, that the parent does escape the domestic violence. They're coming along with that parent.
Sure.
And then ultimately, we then have to, you know, one, make sure that we're there as a support and provide services for them as well. But definitely talking about healthier relationships, that it's not the norm. Because they're torn. Unfortunately, they're in that situation, right? That it's like, well, I'm in the shelter because you left. I don't want to be in the shelter, which is understandable, right? But at the same time, it's one of those things in which they also do know that they saw the violence that they saw. And then it's like being torn in regards to which parent do I align with? I'm angry with you for leaving, but at the same time, I'm angry at this person for causing the fact that there was this violence. But then we also have those situations in which the child then becomes the abuser, right? Not because they want to, but because they saw this dynamic happening and they're angry and they don't know what to do with this. So we have had some parents in which they feel like the child then starts the insult. adults and all of these things that are happening because it's what they know.
Yeah.
And how do you have those conversations with the parent that they're being triggered by the child? They're like, oh, they remind me of my abusive partner. And it's like, yes, it is a trigger and it is a symptom, but understand that your child, it's not that they are maliciously doing these things. They literally are just imitating the symptom that they only know. So yeah, it's tough though.
One of the programs you have at the Secret Garden is Men Have Feelings Too. I love it. The opening, do you feel stuck or tired of things around you not changing? Do your connections feel like they are hurting you or getting you nowhere? Strong words.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been there. Sure, other people have been there as well. Off mic, we were talking about your new program and five men showed up for the new program, which is amazing. How often do you have programs where no men show up?
I'll be honest, with Secret Garden, our most loyal show up clients are the men.
God bless.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah, we have these older gentlemen that come in and they've even, without me knowing, they've exchanged numbers. They keep in contact with each other. And these are men that have become isolated, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they're bridging and creating these bonds. It was interesting. We even had an older gentleman that he's always coming to all of our groups and everything. And he kind of went MIA for a little bit. And we were like, oh no, I hope he's okay. And then we had the other clients say, I've been reaching him and I've been trying and I don't know what's going on. Can you please follow up? What's going on? And, you know, out of confidentiality, we can't say anything, but we're like, oh, you know,
of course,
we hear you. We're going to continue reaching out. We'll see what happens. Thankfully, they reconnected and he came back around. But that's one of the things that we've noticed is that the men definitely are the more isolated in regards to the fact that they feel alone. They feel unbelieved, right? So it's hard for them to open up to other people about it. Let's be honest, the majority of people providing the service are women.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we know it. We're a trigger.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, I didn't think about that. Okay. Sure.
Yeah. We're a trigger for these men, you know, in regards to like, do you really believe me and testing us and all of these things? So I get it. So that's one of the things that we very much try to be mindful about is that now that we have a male case manager, he's been leading the group.
Okay.
And he's leading it with a social work intern who identifies as a man. And it's such a different feeling. Right? Because it's one of those things in which they get to openly feel supported and heard and understood because the men's experience is very different. And what we basically are is we symbolize, right? In regards to the negative experience that we've had. And what's interesting is that once they get over that piece, they forget that we're women to a certain degree because they're like, you know, because women this and women that. And we're like, yeah, we got to sit there and be like, uh-huh.
Not all women.
I'm a woman too, but open it up, talk about it, because that's the real experience that they've had. So it's not personal. We understand that. We are in a society in which for a very long time, the victims were always seen as female. If a man did express being abused, it was either ridiculed, not taken seriously, or it was more of like, well, then why don't you hit back? Or why don't you, you know, you're the man, you're the stronger set.
You're afraid of a little woman, as I was told. You're afraid of a woman? I'm like, no, but yes.
Absolutely. So, you know, and even like, I can even tell you, even as a social worker in my younger age, when I was just getting into the field, I saw other workers, especially men workers, that when we would get a client that was a man, they would be like, really? You know, and it was like, yeah, like these are real things that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that just because a man is supposed to be seen as a stronger sex, it's one of those things in which the feelings get dismissed, the feeling powerless gets dismissed and ridiculed. So it's understandable why this is something that we're trying to break that cycle in, but it's still very much prevalent in there. Right. So these internal messages impact how men will reach out for help.
I remember as a kid, there was a young man who was raped and the cops were given high fives saying, what are you complaining about?
Yeah.
You know, it was by, you know, from a woman. So they were like, what are you worried about? What are you worried about? And you're right. It's rape is rape. And I was very happy to see that the US in 2012 changed the definition of rape. The UK still has it as strictly penetration, which makes it a one-sided crime. And it's not a one-sided crime.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I think it was 2012. The Justice Department changed the definition of rape in here.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. No, definitely. And these conversations need to continue happening. Especially even the struggles that we see in regards to also the validation of gay men, right? In regards to what that is, what that experience is like and being taken seriously. Because for a long time, what do we hear is that when, let's say, two male partners call the police, instead of really seeing what occurred, well, we'll just arrest them both.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, so that happens often.
For a while, they said male domestic violence was strictly caused by another male.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, no, I don't think that's true. And as I grew older, I found out it wasn't.
Oh, absolutely.
Walk us through Men Have Feeling Too, one of the group meetings. You come in, you have a weekly guide, you'd ask questions. Let's see, I'm pulling up the agenda now.
Yes. So one of the things with this that we do want is to make sure that a person can kind of take some inventory and becoming very aware of what were some of the areas when you were growing up, whether it's the internalized messages that you were given or the messages that you saw, right? Because ultimately, what were the first male role models that you had? Mm-hmm. Whether it was your father or not, there is definitely some male role models. Or even we've heard some clients say, well, I didn't have a male role model, but I saw a lot on TV. That can happen too. So in regards to what are some of the internalized messages that you had? What are some of the assumptions that you feel like came out of what it is to be a man? Sometimes people can definitely start talking about that. Well, this is what I saw. This is what I experienced. And I just assume that this is how you're supposed to do things.
Of course.
One of the things that we also would like for the person to definitely explore more about is how is love shown at home, right? Because that can also be something that affection, words of affirmation, that tough love, the discipline, all of these things in regards to how a man is treated differently from a female, that those things are things that we also see happening, right? Certain expectations for females, certain expectations for men.
Yeah.
So how does that impact in regards to how you felt like you had to manage life? So unfortunately, what do we hear a lot? And we still kind of hear sometimes, boys don't cry, right?
Yeah. I'm always explaining the name of the show. It's like, no, I know daddies cry. I get that. It's not what I'm saying.
Yes. What else? Toughen up, right? Take it by the bootstraps.
Yeah. Man up, toughen up.
All these things. And these are really impactful things that happen. And I even shared with you last time, right, that it was one of those things in which even our daughters see this thing, and that can impact how then a female, let's say a female to a male relationship in the future, right? How a female thinks that they can address a man, treat a man.
Yeah.
Or what they expect from that man. So we've also noticed that in regards to the fact that for some, and I'm not saying all, for some women, it could be one of those things in which they can absolutely dismiss that men feel. And that they can take it and they can take anything and they should just take it without realizing that, no, absolutely they feel, absolutely they cry, absolutely they're vulnerable, they get scared. And these are things that I'm even noticing that, like, you know, and I shared with you, I have a daughter, she's only 8 and she'll see certain things and she goes, men cry, boys have feelings. They get nervous. They get scared because there is something about society that internalized for us that somehow they don't get scared. They should be tough. They got it together. They should be the protectors and all these things. And that's really tough because for both the men internalizing it and then the female internalizing it really creates that dynamic that can be unhealthy. So I'm glad that more and more people are talking about the fact that people are vulnerable and have feelings and it's okay. So those are the things that we definitely try to tackle in the men's group, is because we want to see how much of that has impacted you to become who you have become. How much is that has impacted you to be in certain relationships that, you know, enable this type of dynamic? And also, what is it that you really want to bring out and grow from this? Because ultimately, we want a person to be able to normalize these parts of them, come to understanding that it is okay to be vulnerable. It is okay to ask for help. It is okay that you didn't hit back. You're not weak for not doing that. If anything, it's more courage.
Agreed.
And just the fact that you are believed. More than anything, you're believed and you're seen. And we have that space at Secret Garden to be able to do that.
So I grew up in a very loving family, but we yelled. We yelled at each other and we said vile things to each other, not in any meaning, zero meaning behind it. And my buddies growing up would say, oh, you could say this and your parents would say this and then you'd be hugging each other. It's like, yeah, because we don't take it personal. However, what I found in my adult life, and I've said this on the show many times, my ex came from a screaming household as well. So what did we bring to our house? Two people, two idiots, one who said vile, vile things. And she came from a family of needlers. So she would needle, needle, needle. I'd vile, vile, vile until, you know, the relationship eroded. But you need to learn from these things. You need to look back. did I grow up in a comfortable situation? You know, does two people fighting make me feel comfortable?
Mm-hmm.
Then you should probably reevaluate your comfort level. And then again, I'm not a doctor or a psychologist. I wouldn't know how to go about that. When you have people come in, do you have certain thresholds where you'll be like, you need somebody more qualified, for lack of a better word? Maybe you should get more help.
The only threshold that we would tell clients that we're not able to manage is for those who, let's say, have severe mental illness. Now, that basically means symptoms that are impacting your daily functioning, right?
Okay.
Hallucinations, delusions,
sure.
Certain things that really make it hard to tap into what we need to do in real time and what's really happening. So we always let the client know. If it is that they are aware that there is a history, we do want to do collaborative work, because ultimately what we've noticed is that we will try to work on certain things in regards to, like, let's say the traumas, or work on having healthier relationship. But if that symptom is impacting and it's making it hard for the person to be able to process this, because it's more of like, you know, I'm being seen, or I'm being persecuted, or I'm being chased, then it makes it really hard, because then we're just kind of like managing that symptom for that moment. But that symptom we know needs possibly medication. So that could probably be what the threshold is. The other piece is, if there is a history of substance abuse, we do know that if the person comes to the program intoxicated, we're not doing effective work.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Doesn't mean we'll turn away. We'll just be more realistic of like, listen, there are some tiers and levels that need to be taken care of first.
That makes sense.
And we're here to collaborate and support and take care of the other areas with you.
And people need to take accountability, because as my dad has said, it takes two to tango.
Yeah.
Now, building better relationships, we had spoken a little earlier, you were saying, you know, men will come in and they'll vent about women. And I'm in a number of different support groups.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the common themes, and the leaders, for lack of a better word, of the support groups all say it becomes a complaining fest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just woman bashing. And then you got to reel the guys back in. You let them get it out. Mm-hmm. We get it. You're upset.
Of course.
You bring it back in. What advice would you give people in this situation to find a better relationship, other than take everything you've just done and don't do that again?
Heal yourself.
Excellent.
I mean, ultimately, you got to heal yourself. If you're not healthy, you're not going to be able to maintain a healthy relationship.
Excellent.
And it's not to ever say that a survivor is at fault. No, you will never be at fault of someone else's behavior. But we do know psychologically there is something internalized that attracts us to a certain person, right?
Correct.
And it could be that that person triggers us in a certain way. That, have you ever heard someone say, and we hear this a lot, but they feel like home,
mm-hmm.
but they feel familiar.
Absolutely.
And they feel like there's a bond there. There is. It's most of the time trauma bonding. Most of the time it has to do with, if your home wasn't very healthy, it does feel like home. But was your home healthy? You know, did they show ways to really manage emotions, to be able to deal with a conflict in a healthier way? So that's the piece that it's like looking internally, because ultimately what does happen is that the more you realize your worth, your value, and how you should be addressed and talked to and treated, the more you don't put up with a person that will act that way.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's easy, and it's not going to be an easy formula. It takes years many times to be able to get to that point. We know that. And it's not an easy fix. So unfortunately, we can't be like, well, just remember the red flags from the last relationship and that's it. No, because we're so complex. And many of us, what happens is that we'll excuse the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
For many of us, it really is that internal loneliness, right? It's really scary.
Yeah.
Many times we do look for an attachment that makes us feel less alone, that makes us feel like at least we're loved or valued or seen. But the problem with that is that then we're always looking for that external piece to make us feel whole instead of feeling whole.
Okay.
And then sharing it with someone else.
Yes.
Which I know sounds super cliche,
no.
But it really is something to it. Yeah.
And that stems back to, don't be like me. Don't crawl into a bottle in a Brooklyn basement and think you're going to get better. That doesn't help. You have to get out. You have to see yourself as a good person.
Yeah. And honestly, it's like seeing those really ugly parts about us, right? And it's not to say that we're going to sit there and look at all of our negatives, because we try to really come from a strength-based perspective with our clients.
Excellent.
It's more of like, what are the parts of me that keep me unhealthy? What are the parts of me, whether it's the way that I see myself, the way that the world made me see myself, especially with us, we work towards with clients who have a disability. Mm-hmm. As we know, disability absolutely puts people in a box of being unworthy, not being able to do things, limiting a person with a disability, and always putting them in a box of like, well, these are kind of like the people that are out there in the world and, you know, they can't function to our level. They're not really worthy. They're not sexual. They're not all of these things, without realizing that there is a huge world of people who identify with a disability that, you know, come from different levels of functioning and abilities. Mm-hmm. Maybe they just do things differently. So one of the things that I'll share, and when we do our outreach and education with people, myself and also one of the executive team leaders who we do this, we start our training with sharing the fact that we are people with a disability. So I have disabilities. If you see me, you wouldn't, mm-hmm. wouldn't guess it, right?
Would not.
But so it's one of those things in which the fact is that I am neurodivergent. I'm not neurotypical. I have ADHD.
Okay.
Right. So the way that I process things is differently. I actually have to wear specialized contacts because I'm legally blind. I can see, but I can't see if I didn't have these amazing contact lenses.
My four-year-old is visually impaired. We're going Boston Children's a lot now these days.
Yeah. And the fact is that also I live in chronic pain every day. I have a diagnosis that I'm in pain constantly. And some days, if you see me, you're like, what happened to you? You don't look well. And I'm like, I'm just going through it. I have my flare up. And some days I literally can't get up.
Not fibromyalgia, is it?
Endometriosis. So it's one of those things in which that pain will absolutely drain you and the fatigue is real. My focusing, I'm like in a fog all day and people can tell, right? But I've had to share this piece and I felt safe sharing this piece about me at this organization because at other places of work, I'm like, oh, you know, they're going to make assumptions that she's not going to get the job done.
Yeah.
So a lot of people keep that to themselves. So I'm going to tie that into the fact of that disability piece and how the world sees us and then being a man.
Yeah.
Right. And being a man, you're seen as a powerhouse with certain strengths and everything. And then to put that disability piece, there's a lot of shame. There's a lot of guilt. There's a lot of I should, could, and, you know, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And I'm not able to take care of things because of this. You know, that definitely impacts your self-esteem.
I think that's amazing because I never really thought of the stereotype of a male is really a disability to the rest of us who don't identify as a Navy SEAL. We can't keep up. We can't fight as well. You know, there's always someone bigger than you. Mm-hmm. And I never thought what that could do to a person's self-esteem. I'm average in every way, so I've always been decent enough to make it by. But yeah, I'm going to be pondering this for a couple of days now.
Yeah, I'm glad I gave something to ponder about.
Yeah, no, it's just a really interesting way of looking at it, how you see yourself. And we would see ourselves in a disabled manner compared to a stereotypical male.
Mm-hmm.
I'll make that sound a lot better, but at the same time.
No, definitely. I'll be honest. Sometimes we have to really call out the client on some of their behaviors and be like, is that working for you? You know, it's just really being reflective. Like, where did that come from? Where did you learn that behavior? What do you think impacted you to see the world that way or to have that expectation of people? Right. Because one of the things that really does happen is mm-hmm. we're like, well, they should ... They should either feel sorry for what they did. They should change. They should do better. They should know better. And it's true, maybe, but you waiting for them to do what you think that the person should and could do is going to then be a detriment to yourself. Now you're paralyzing yourself in this situation, hoping that this person is going to change when really you have to focus on your change.
Absolutely.
What is your change that will help you to get to a place where you're like, I don't deserve this. I need to do better. And I can, right? Because then that's the other part that we tie in is what told you in society that you can't, that you're stuck on that I can't, instead of really trying to push through. And I'm not saying that everybody can do this because we're all, again, different levels of functioning, but seeing, are there different ways that I'm able to do things that empower me that maybe I didn't think of because I didn't know I could, right? let's say, is there the possibility that some of these symptoms can be taken care of with medication? Maybe. Is there a certain type of treatment that's out there that might be able to help you gain that strength? Maybe. Is there a certain type of, like, we've even gone to conventions, I've seen conventions of accessibility tools. There are tools that are out there that can actually help a person be able to do things on their own, whether it's a contraption that helps you to be able to get dressed or feed yourself or be able to reach things. There are these things out there, but we really, and that's what we try to empower the client to know, there are places that are accessible. There are tools that exist that you would have to apply for to be able to get these tools to help you to be more independent.
Yeah.
There are evaluations that are out there. It's not easy. We know that. But we try to just see what are the parts that you think that you can't do. And let's see. Let's see. Maybe there is a tool out there that can help you to get to a better place.
It's a good segue for this. One of the questions you have is, what role do you think people in your family see you as having versus what role you see yourself having? Can you touch into that question a little bit?
Sure. As we were saying before, right, in regards to the fact that sometimes there are roles that people tell you that you're supposed to play in your home, mm-hmm. whether it's the breadwinner role, right? The person who needs to make sure and take care of their household in more ways than one, typically doesn't touch into the emotional piece. And that's the piece that we want them to kind of like tap into and explore. Is it that you have felt for a very long time that your role as a man is to only be a provider? To be a protector, and not to say that they can't, but are these other roles that you feel like you fit into, that you feel like you haven't been able to completely be yourself in out of being judged or out of being seen as weak? So being able to tap into who are you and that you hide and who do you present to the world versus who do you really feel that you are internally?
Interesting.
I remember also doing this activity even with kids, right? We have a mask. We have the mask that we show the world. Mm-hmm. And what do those adjectives look like? And then we have what's internal. What is it that we're hiding? And what do those adjectives look like? Because that's what a lot of times happen is that, you know, a person will present a certain way as charismatic, as this, as that, and they're happy and they have to be, right? They have to be this strong pillar. And then at home, if it's not a safe place, then they hide in other ways, right? Behind alcohol, behind drugs, behind doing other things that are hidden. Mm-hmm. Right? Because of the fact that it's one of those things in which it's an internalized battle in regards to who you're supposed to be and who you really are.
Yeah. Another role dads have, which is unfortunate, is the enforcer. Wait till your dad gets home. Wait till your dad gets home. They put the fear of God into him and dad becomes the fear.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is not the way to go, guys. I mean, I grew up with a, you know, Vietnam vet who was raised by a World War II vet. Again, as loving as they could be. Love you to death, dad. But the showing of love was... Mm-hmm. not known to them, so they weren't able to pass it down. You said there's a lot of resources out there, and you're absolutely correct. I mean, I was able to get books. How do I become a better father to my son? I have three daughters and a son. I know how to love daughters. Mm. I saw my dad love my sisters. It's just, but that's the way he grew up. Dad loved the girls, mom loved the boys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easy for me with my daughters. I know exactly how a father's supposed to do that. With my son, we both said, again, he's eight as well, but we're going to have the best father-son relationship.
Yeah.
There are resources out there if you do look.
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right. It has to start internally, which is really the person picking up the phone and getting help.
Yeah. And that's why it's great. And I appreciate that you're having this platform to share that information, because sometimes it's like, you don't know if you don't know, right? What do you know is out there if you don't? Or unfortunately, there are situations in which a person does pick up the phone, then they get that one person or that one place that's like, no, you know, we can't serve you.
Yeah.
Whether it's because you have a disability or whether it's because we're not serving men, we only are serving female survivors. So that deters the wanting to do anything and being like, oh, well, there you go. I tried.
And that's actually one of the unfortunate parts. Even just today, I was Googling domestic violence shelters for men just to see if anything new has changed. And when you get one in Dallas, one in Miami-Dade, one in Arkansas, and you guys.
So limited. I don't know why.
Well, it's all the old stereotypes, unfortunately, but hopefully those get broken down. And I think there's over 2,000 shelters for women in the country.
Sure there is, yeah. They're seen as the vulnerable population.
Up until 20 years ago, I would have thought the exact same thing. I would have thought, you know, domestic violence was either male on male or male on female. We were talking today how my little guy was sick and he went to school. And Why Daddy Never Cries podcast hosts, a man who's done years and years of soul searching, almost told his 8-year-old son, this is what it's like being a guy, suck it up and go to school. Almost.
Yeah, but you were able to catch yourself.
I told him sometimes we have to do things we don't want to do. Sometimes we have to rise above how we feel. And then unfortunately, he did get sick when he was at school, but but he persevered. But yeah, it's tough. And I still, to this day, hold myself to some of those stereotypes. Like I would naturally be the first one to run into, well, I'm also a first responder, but I'd also be the first one to run into a situation as opposed to running away from a situation.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I'm not the biggest guy in the world. So there's only so much I can do.
Yeah. But, you know, the fact that you're like you said, you're reflecting on that, right? It's like, but you're kind of expected to be this person, right?
Yeah.
To be the one to kind of be in the forefront. And that's just the way that it's internalized. So it's like when something is so ingrained and it's just a part of us, it feels natural.
Yes.
And that's the part that with the changing that we try to do in therapy, right? It's, we always tell our clients, it's going to feel very unnatural to a point that you're going to feel like, I'm not being true to myself. Well, are you not being true to the self that was created based on society and upbringing?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it that because it's so unfamiliar that you feel like you're somehow going against the grain, against yourself, that it is going to feel uncomfortable? But like everything, it will come to an adjustment in which you are going to feel healthier. It's just that, unfortunately, it's going to get very uncomfortable and very painful before you get to that place.
Oh, and I can give the audience a perfect story for this. So coming from a yelling household, first marriage, a yelling marriage.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked very, very hard at eliminating yelling from my life. However, every now and then, my wife will tell me, why are you yelling? To which I'll respond, this is not yelling. However, to where she grew up, this is yelling.
Yelling, yeah.
And it is at least 100 decibels lower than what I grew up around. So I'm like, I don't get it. Yeah, you're right. It's going to be uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And getting comfortable with the uncomfortableness. But you're right, right? Like just even that, you're like, oh, you want to see yelling? I'll show you what yelling sounds like.
You didn't grow up in New York. I grew up in New York. I'll tell you what yelling looks like.
Yeah. So we tend to be loud, right? And even that, it's one of those things, as I was sharing with you before, it's not to say that these are questions that all men should be able to reflect on. The only thing is that with our client population, which are typically more men of color, we also do have to add that added layer of what it's like to be a man of color, because that in itself, in regards to the culture, in regards to just certain things that we hear that can possibly be different, right? What is one stereotype that we hear about Black men? They never had a dad, right? The great thing is that the other day I saw an article that said that thankfully, that number has increased. And now there are so many more men that are involved in their children's lives that are men of color. So that cycle is definitely being broken. But for many of the older generation, if that was their experience in regards to not having that male figure, then it was like, you know, for that dad that left the household, then it was that oldest son that had to step up and be the man of the house.
Right.
What was that experience? And then in a world in regards to all the other layers that happen in the world that can be traumatizing for what it is to be a man of color. So all of those things compiled and then having to like really process what that was like in regards to probably having a mom that was very tough,
yeah.
Right? We had to be, we're in survival mode. We have to be that tough mom. So maybe that affection wasn't there. Maybe just basically that internalized tolerance. I remember growing up as a Latina, right? I would have friends that would be like, why is that mom yelling at that kid? I'm like, they're not yelling. That's how we talk. we're loud.
Yep.
We just need to get our point across. And I myself can empathize with you because sometimes my daughter's like, why are you yelling at me? I said, I'm not yelling. I'm just getting my message through.
Yeah.
But then I got to scale it back and be like, ah, here comes my what I grew up with, right? So it's one of those things in which we have to kind of like check ourselves. And it is, it's hard because I feel like many days we will have those days in which we're like, ah, I didn't have a great day. So tomorrow's a new day and I got to really catch myself and just do better.
Everybody makes mistakes. Everybody trips up. Everyone takes a step back or even three every now and then.
Absolutely.
But knowing that, identifying it and recovering from it, it's all the difference. And that's all anybody, I think, is asking anybody to do is understand where you made a mistake, step back, and try not to make that mistake again. If you keep making the same mistake, you're not trying.
Yeah. If you're not at least holding yourself accountable, which is one of the hardest things to do, right?
Yes, it is.
Like, well, you got to look at yourself in the mirror. We're so quick to point the finger and be like, you did this and they did that. But then when we got to look at that mirror, that's uncomfortable.
Yeah, but you know, she needled me. Well, what'd you call her? I guess that was kind of bad too. Yeah. You got to look at yourself. You got to understand what you're bringing to the table. Or as my dad said, how I react to things. Like I would get needled, I'd curse you out, as opposed to just saying why, or even just trying to even empathize with the person or sympathize if you can't empathize. Why are they acting this way? Maybe I came home to a house where the kids were horrible for one day, or somebody's got a migraine. You don't know. You don't know what that person went through.
Absolutely.
And it is one of the hardest things. But that's kind of the way I'm trying to live now, is try to see life through the other person's eyes. And then, I don't know, and just try not to make the same mistakes, especially generational.
Mm-hmm.
One of your guys' weekly exercises is a breathing exercise. And I'm just curious if it's the same one I've been preaching for the last 10 years. That's one of the main things I think every person out there has to do when confronted in any situation that's uncomfortable, is breathe, then react. Can you want to talk to us about the breathing exercise?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we kind of do like this body scan, right? Body scan is important because sometimes we don't realize when our levels are up, right? Whether it's that we're feeling anxious, whether it's that we're feeling frustrated or angry. So we kind of do a body scan for people to become aware of, where does it hit you? Some people it hits your head, some people your chest, your stomach, your legs, your arms, wherever it is. So first doing that body scan, and then, you know, we definitely know that sometimes it feels silly. And it also feels like it's not going to work, but it really does.
Really does.
Ultimately, what happens when our blood is rushing is that we are getting a certain type of lack of oxygen, and lack of oxygen makes us more impulsive and reactive.
Mm-hmm.
So it is important to hold it in. So we kind of do kind of like, it could be a 5-7-5, right? You hold, count, breathe in, count to 5, hold for 7, and then slowly breathe out through your mouth, out 5. And what that basically does is that you're holding the oxygen that your mind and your brain need in order for you to bring down your levels. Do it as many times as you need. And then at the end, we always do a check-in of, okay, so let's say you started at an 8. Where are you now?
Okay.
And trying to make sure that what it's doing is that it's bringing the levels down for them to feel better. And breathing is important. Very mindful breathing is what's important.
We preach the box breathing religiously. The body scan, can you walk us through that? Because I've never heard of that, but I do notice I clench.
Yes.
Before I start. So,
So your hands.
And I didn't actually notice that till we started talking.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's one of the things I do, is I'll clench.
Mm-hmm.
So how can someone perform the body scan?
So it's interesting. There are different activities, right? We can tell a person, think about something that's super stressful. And then we ask them to, okay, from head to toe. And we do it differently. You can either sit and kind of do the body scan, or if you need a visual, do a printout of a body, right? And kind of say, okay, when I'm feeling stressed, when I'm feeling frustrated or angry, and that memory, let's say that visual memory is bringing you to that area. Do you feel your, let's start with your head. Do you feel anything in your head? Do you feel heat in your ears? Do you feel like your chest is getting tight? Do you feel like you're getting nauseous or there's butterflies in your stomach? The clenching is definitely one of them. Your palms getting sweaty? Yeah. Do you feel like there's some heat or some discomfort in your legs? Are they starting to feel shaky? So you go through all of those, and that way the person can become very aware. Those are your alarms, which is really good, because once you're aware of your alarms, that's when you have to cue yourself. Before I get to X, Y, and Z point of reaction, let me do that box breathing. Let me tell my body I am safe, because that's the part that happens, is that your body reacts, right? And then what happens? Your amygdala goes off.
Yeah.
The amygdala is the alarm that basically says you're in danger, you're in danger. You're going to defend yourself. You could become defensive. You could start yelling. You could start screaming. You could start throwing things. You could start doing a lot of things. So
fight or flight. Yep.
Yeah. It's very normal and natural. So what you're basically telling your amygdala is, well, hold on. I know where this is coming from, but I am safe. Like, even if you have to scope out the room, what in this room makes me feel safe? There is the person who caused the harm isn't here, right? There are people here that are safe. I am in my home. And it is safe. And then as you're breathing and you're grounding yourself, is what we're calling it,
mm-hmm.
You can definitely see that there is going to be a difference, but it takes a lot of practice.
I love the screen.
And sometimes it's easier to just react, right? You just let out that steam.
A lot easier.
It is a lot easier. So it's very mindful, definitely work that you have to kind of say, I need to do these exercises, because what happens when you have that explosion? You regret it afterwards.
Yeah.
Feel like that emotional beat up.
Mm-hmm.
You really do feel beat up emotionally. And you're like, it wasn't even worth it, because now that I'm calm, you know, I gave in to the beast.
Yeah. You got to go back and rectify, apologize, do whatever you have to do. You just add another layer of nonsense onto your day.
Absolutely.
I love the body screening idea. And I love the idea that you do it before. So normally when you get into a situation, start box breathing. But if you put yourself in a situation in a safe place and practice box breathing, you'll feel that. So I'll start thinking about a stressful situation. I could do that. that all day long. And then you start feeling where you feel it. That's how I started feeling myself clenching. Instantly caught myself clenching my fist. And I was like, wow, I never realized I did that. So you can almost take somebody out of a rage situation by doing all three. Recognize, deal with, extra level of help if need be.
Yeah, we actually have this really great program in my past life that we used to do with teenagers because we want teenagers to start these skills at a very young age. And one of the things that we would do is we would have them watch a scary movie, right? Silence of the Lambs.
Okay.
And we would pause it, have a person do the body scan. But then what we would do is in front of them, we would give them all these tools for all their five senses. So something to smell, something to taste, something to listen to, something to watch, and something to touch.
Okay.
And then because people are very different, not every stimulant is going to work the same way. So we would ask them to grade for themselves which one worked the best. So a lot of people, it's like for me, like I know I love my candles. Candles and touching something that is really soft really bring me down. For other people, they're like, no, I need visuals. I need to look at puppies and kittens and all these things. And that's like, it's great if that's what works for you. Or for some people, music, right? Mm-hmm. For me, I need like my music to help me focus. So everybody's different and they learn that about themselves and they're like, all right, now I have these external tools also.
It's funny, as a musician, I can't listen to music because I'll focus on the music and not on what I'm trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. So it's got to be quiet for me.
Erica
Calderon from Barrier Free Living, Freedom House Safe Shelter, The Secret Garden Counseling, Barrier for Life Apartments, and soon to come Freedom Village, which we haven't even touched on yet, which is a 13-story building you guys are built for a whole village for this. This is great.
Yeah. Yes. And that's going to be a category in its own in regards to people who I believe are 55 and older. So it's going to be for those, especially for those who are going to transition out of a nursing home. Because we do have clients, right? We have clients that unfortunately, because of the disability, because of domestic violence, have ended up in nursing home facilities. But ultimately, we know that a nursing home wouldn't be the most ideal place for them long term. So it's going to be, you know, a great place for them to be able to have their independent living while also getting the support that they need.
That's awesome. As always, all your contact information and where people can find you will be in the show notes. But where can people find you for those driving in the car?
Absolutely. So you can look up our website, which is BFL for Barrier Free Living. NYC for New York City.org. And also our hotline, which is 212-533-4358. And also if you go onto our website, there's an escape button. Let's say that if you needed to be able to get out quickly from the website, but on the corner of the website is a red circle that says chat hotline. If you'd like to chat with someone live, and that's Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. But if you call our hotline after hours, you will still be answered by Safe Horizon.
Okay, cool. And that chat, that button's at the bottom right-hand corner of the website.
Yeah.
Erica, I learned something on all these shows, and I tell you, I learned a lot today. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Yes.
And like I said, there are a lot of people around the country looking to help men who are victims of domestic violence, and this show is going to help them a lot understand at least where to start.
Well, thank you for doing what you're doing and for spreading the information and the education that's out there and that we're here. There is support.
You're frontline, and thank you for doing what you're doing.
Thank you. And if you need me to come back because you want more information, I'm more than happy to do that.
I think we're going to get a lot of people from around the country wanting you back on the show. So yeah, this was great.
All right, Chuck. Talk to you soon. Thank you.
Bye. God bless, and I'll talk to you soon. Have fun today. Bye.
We must get our voices out there. Send us your stories to whydaddynevercries@gmail.com or whydaddynevercries on Facebook. Remember, this is a daily and sometimes hourly struggle. So follow us on Daddy Never Cries at Twitter and Why Daddy Never Cries on Instagram and let your voice be heard. Let's end the fatherless children syndrome that's plaguing this world.
The team of Why Daddy Never Cries consists of Joe, the voice of reason, Nicole Kelleher, and Scott Hall. Thanks, everybody. You can't change what happened to you, brothers. What you can control, however, is how you react to every situation. So you got to figure out how to make it work for you. And when life gave me lemons, I said to hell with the glass. I'm making an international lemonade franchise. So until next time, you've got this, Daddy.